Welcome to Rooster Radio, where we talk to interesting people doing amazing things. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. Today we sit down with Greg Mackey, who is one of South Australia's most influential people in arts and culture. For Greg, the journey started with his family bookstore, which built a cult following in the Adelaide CBD. The in-store events took a life of their own and were the genesis of what would become the Adelaide Festival of Ideas, which was founded by Greg. He then applied for the state's most senior arts gig, CEO of Arts SA, and to his surprise, he got the job. It was a steep learning curve, but Greg quickly found success. Through this role and other influential positions within the public sector, Greg increased investment in the arts and also oversaw a number of cultural and social innovations. Greg is particularly unique in that he has somehow found a way to make art, entrepreneurship, and government work together. He reveals why and shares really important insights about how to cut through red tape and get things done in the public sector. He also put the arts community on notice about the reality of funding and the future of the arts, as well as leadership, his story, and much more. Enjoy our chat with Greg Mackey.
Greg Mackey, welcome to Rooster Radio.
Thanks, guys.
I'd like to start with imprints. How old were you when, I guess, the business took shape?
1984, we opened Imprints, and so I was turning 25, and it was started by my father and stepmother and a very good friend of theirs, Tricia Sykes, and they needed somebody to do the weekend graveyard shifts. We used to open till 11:30 at night back in those days, and I had gone back to uni and was finishing my VA, and I said, yeah, I can do that. And by that stage, I'd already done a Myer retail cadetship and been a divisional buyer for Myer. And so I knew stuff about running businesses. And within 6 months, I kind of ended up really running the business, which was fantastic and scary and very, very long hours.
And I should have said up front, I mean, Imprints is a bookshop.
Indeed, Imprints is a bookshop down in beautiful downtown Hindley Street, which in the mid-80s, or by the mid-80s, was probably at the beginning of its big decline. It had had decades of being a really exciting, vibrant street. It was one of the retail hearts of Adelaide, and certainly there was an entertainment focus there, even more so than these days. There were amusement parlours, there was ice skating, there was all sorts of stuff down there, and multiple cinemas before the multi-screen cinema complex happened. There were five different cinemas down in Hindley Street.
And explain how Imprints, I guess, built a brand that became iconic within Adelaide and South Australia. I mean, people, it was a destination, and everyone talked about it.
I think that people came to talk about it because we couldn't afford to splash money around on expensive advertising, and so word of mouth became our most important means of promotion. And we achieved that, I think, by being decent people, by being generous, by being knowledgeable, by being good listeners to our customers, and by taking their feedback and having that help shape and hone the selection of books that we offered. And back in those days, of course, we weren't alone in the book trade down there. There was Third World Bookshop, which had been quite an institution and was open late nights, seven nights a week. We just opened until 11:30 p.m. on Friday and Saturday nights, and that was a long shift to do when you're the only person in the shop and the toilet was way down in the basement. And
interesting characters.
Bladder control was a key competitive advantage, let me tell you.
How important was the curation aspect of running the bookstore and choosing what to have?
It's a bit akin to being a librarian, where you're shaping and honing a collection that is a reflection of your own interests and the interests of your customers. And yeah, it was quite a buzz every month. And this is back before email and all things digital. People, reps would come in, they would sit down with a catalogue and some samples and they'd step you through that. A lot of that is now done online. And you would order books in a handwritten order and you would pop it into the letterbox and post it. And it was a very, very different world. And that's not all that long ago. We're talking the 80s.
Did you bolt on other things other than just selling books to create this sort of a brand?
Look, I think the thing that we did bolt on was events. So we had a very active program called the PM Club, and we brought writers to Adelaide and hosted events for our audiences where they could hear perhaps a reading from the guest writer and ask questions, and a bit like a literary festival would be, but with one star.
How do you reflect on the changing market over the last 5 to 10 years in the book space, where content seems to be more valuable than ever, but it's completely changed the way we consume it?
There's no question that the advent of screen-based digital content purchasing and access has fundamentally changed, but it's never killed the book, and I don't believe it ever will kill the book. There is still something fundamentally cultural about an object, and a digital download, whilst yes, it's a manifestation of an object, it's not an object in its own right. A lot of people I know consume that they're reading content now both digitally and still in print magazines, still in print books. And some people prefer more exclusively one platform over another. It's made... It's like I would akin it to Uber and taxis. There are new competitors. When things happened like the GST came in, that was a huge change for all sorts of retail industry. When in the book industry, Amazon Books, Amazon.com came on, that was a huge change. When Borders came to town, they were a massive store, which now, of course, younger people won't even know about Borders because it came in. It drove a lot of small independent book shops out of business, and then it drove itself out of business. And so the marketplace, the places for the procuring of books has really dramatically changed, and not just in Adelaide but across the world.
I'm wondering if these early stages was formative for you because you've got this commercial reality and you've got a drive the numbers and make a profit, but you've got a world of, you know, thinking and ideas and bringing people together as a community. I'm wondering if those trends have kind of continued, do you think?
Yeah, look, when my folks conceived Imprints, and they'd both been in the book trade for many years in different capacities, they perceived a gap in the marketplace at that point, and that led to Imprints. When I came into the business fairly shortly thereafter, I brought my sensibility and my interest in books as an aspect of culture, and the events side of things, getting involved with Adelaide Writers Week, from there subsequently developing the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. These were ways of promoting the book and the notion of ideas and knowledge as actually something that we value in the culture. What I think that was... for me, what drove me, and I know what drove my folks, was we were never in the business to get rich, and we were never in the business to create a franchise that we would flog into other places. We wanted Imprints to be a one and only, and I'm thrilled that still now, 34 years, 33 years later, it's still alive.
So you touched on the events side of your world. Can you maybe tell us what was that experience like when you first started to get involved in festivals, and what were, I guess, the key challenges that, that came about, particularly early on?
Adelaide Writers Week, which had been in existence like the Adelaide Festival of Arts, of which it's a part, since 1960, was and continues to be an amazing gesture of generosity on the part of, I guess, for starters, the state government, who were the primary funder. But, you know, it's free access to most of the opportunity, most of the program over the week. It was a wonderful element of South Australia's principles and philosophy around equity, and that had a big impact on me. It led to, obviously, from a bookseller's perspective, you make your money on selling the book, but you make the event free. When I developed our own PM Club program for visiting authors, because people at 6 p.m. you lure them in also with, you know, a bit of fat on a biscuit and some bubbles. we had a bit of cost to recover, but we always kept that ticket price very, very keen. But it did come to actually amount to a reasonable percentage of our overall business mix. And so, yeah, having a range of services and offerings that are priced differently, and also always maintaining a principle of equity and affordability was important then, and that shaped and went on to inform my approach to events, and then, you know, later on, of course, as the state's head cultural administration, cultural policy guy as well.
Before we move on to and leave the imprints chapter behind, see what I did there?
Very good.
Just a couple of highlights, one or two of the sort of the authors that really left a mark on you that you brought out and dealt with.
The travel writer Bill Bryson, who's just such a fantastic raconteur. I mean, we had 600 people at the what was then the Hindley Park Royal in Hindley Street, and they were hanging on to every word. He was utterly charming. He was not in any way elitist. So at one end, I would put Bill Bryson among the most memorables. At another end, I'd put the Australian writer Robert Desay in a memorable position, and we hosted Robert on three or four times over the years in Adelaide. And he had been Radio National's books and writing presenter, and so he had a profile amongst a certain segment of the community, and people loved him, and they loved his erudition, and they loved his spoken voice most particularly. Amongst the more hilarious, I would put Dame Joan Sutherland, of course, you know, La Stupenda, a global name and an amazing musician. But sometimes people's art is the best thing that they have to contribute, and they may hide behind their art, and Dame Joan was one of those people. And we had this event in the Hindley Park Royal, and again, they were packed from the rafters, and there was a broadcaster from Radio National who did an interview because Dame Joan was not comfortable to speak really terribly much, and actually her biography was pretty boring, really. Her autobiography, I should say, was pretty boring. It was simply a chapter and verse account of her performances, etc. You didn't get much insight into the woman. The woman herself was a very private individual. She liked doing tapestry and was very homely, a very homely sort of person. But she turns up in her chiffon, her famous chiffon outfit, and her sort of buffon,
big
hair. And that Sunday afternoon, out the front of the Hindley Park Royal for hours was a gaggle of clear fans, including one young guy. I'm going to guess he might have been of Italian or Greek background, and he had this massive, it looked like a huge surfboard, and what it was the spoiler for the back of his car, and on it was an image of Dame Joan and, you know, La Stupenda, and he had grown up listening to her music and was a huge fan. And so she signed, very graciously signed, this spoiler to go on the back of his car. I mean, that kind of dedication is pretty out there.
I have to ask just one more. Any intimidating figures that kind of, you know, put you on edge?
I wouldn't say so much intimidating, but there were certainly plenty of people whose intellects I revered and was in awe of. I did make one really, really stupid mistake one day. Occasionally you end up introducing an author whose work you've never read, and the author Joanna Trollope was one of those, and I'd got my Trollopes confused between Anthony Trollope, you know, the English writer of the century before, whose pastoral novels were quite gorgeous, and Joanna Trollope, and I made the mistake of starting the Q&A part by sort of asking her about, you know, writing the pastoral novel, and she kind of very politely but pretty quickly put me in my place and said, you may not have read my books, Greg, but they're anything but pastoral. And I ate humble pie for the rest of that evening.
I'm glad you said that, because I've got a number of questions about, you know, the Geelong Premiership years for Mr. Andrew Mackey, but I'm also really interested, just as we follow the events theme, kind of the genesis behind your Festival of Ideas, and quite interested in the motivation behind that.
Fairly simply, I'd spent a decade involved with Adelaide Writers Week, and I had come to chair that program development committee for Barry Kosky from the mid-90s and continued on. And over that time, and I think still largely subsequently, Adelaide Writers Week is a literary festival. Its focus is on poetry, on creative prose, works of the creative imagination, more so than necessarily non-fiction, although there has always been a place in the Writers Week program for historical biography and autobiography and travel literature. And myself and my colleagues at the time really quite liked keeping it that way, that we weren't going to turn it into a book festival. It was about writers and the creative imagination. That then, as a bookseller, still left to me another whole world of interesting people and interesting creators of original work who didn't have a place in the Writers Week platform. And out of that, I guess, was born the idea of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. It was a chance encounter in a sandwich bar in Hindley Street, getting my lunch one day, and the then Minister for the Arts, the Honourable Diana Laidlaw, was in front of me, and we just started chatting, and I said, I must come and see you one day and talk to you about an idea I've got for a new festival. This was in 1998, and she said, we've got a minute here, Greg. You know, give me what we would now say your elevator pitch.
Yeah, pitch it to me.
just give me the idea, and I sort of said, think about Writers Week, but think about it for non-fiction. And immediately, click, she got it. And that afternoon, she called me up into her office, and we sat out on her balcony. And Di used to love a ciggy or six. By the end of that conversation, she'd called in her then chief executive of Transport Urban Planning and the Arts, Tim O'Loughlin. And she said, Greg, how much do you need to get this started? And I said, $100,000 would be a great start, Di. And she said, Tim, find $100,000 for Greg's new festival. And that was amazing. And from there, I then went to see the then Lord Mayor of Adelaide, Dr. Jane Lomax Smith, and she similarly embraced it fairly quickly, could understand that this was something that spoke to the temperament of Adelaide, to our intellectual traditions, and the principle that I espoused, that it was a free event, therefore we weren't excluding people by dint of economics. And I walked out of there with a pretty clear commitment to $50,000. So then I had $150,000, which meant I had something to start to work with. And we then, I went to Sydney with the chief executive of the Adelaide Festival Corporation, and we got Nokia on board as a sponsor. And back then, Nokia was the tops, you know, the little Nokia phone. iPhones hadn't yet been invented, and in fact, social media really hadn't been invented. So it was as quick and as simple and as positive as that. And I know plenty of people who have great ideas who have really struggled to get oxygen for them. I was incredibly lucky.
Why?
Because you got on the SIGs with Diana.
Well, I think Di had an appetite for new festivals. She had supported the start of Sala Festival in 97 or 98, because this year's the 20th anniversary of the Sala Festival, and she'd supported the Adelaide Cabaret Festival as a new festival. So, you know, in all credit to Di, she understood the place of the notion of the festival in our culture.
And we're going to touch on, I guess, government's role with this down the track, but for those who aren't as familiar, what are the mechanics of Writers Week and the Festival Ideas? On the ground, what actually happens?
On the ground, Writers Week is supported by the Adelaide Festival Corporation, so it has a back end that is in the business of presenting festivals. Now, back in the day, the Adelaide Festival of Arts and Adelaide Writers Week and the Adelaide Fringe and WOM Adelaide, they were all biennial festivals. They happened every 2 years. I never wanted to create an organisation for the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. I wanted it to be a project that would be auspiced by an existing organisation, so we didn't have to duplicate and create expensive back ends in order to make it happen. And so it required the formation of an advisory committee, and I chaired the advisory committee if we're talking Festival of Ideas, and we had an executive producer. And that executive producer for the first decade was Rose White, who also was the executive producer of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. And because both events were biennial, it was like 1 year was one and 1 year was the other, and it all flowed well. Then by the mid-noughties, because I had ended up finding myself running Arts SA and contributing ideas to cultural policy, it was a big thing for me that we should make our biennial festivals annual and enable the community to benefit every year in the same way that communities in other states and everywhere around the world benefit from annual festivals. At that point, Adelaide Festival couldn't continue to, or chose not to continue to produce the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. But by that stage, I was further up the slippery pole in the Department of Premier and Cabinet as Deputy Chief Executive for Cultural Development, and I was able to insource the production of the 2011 Adelaide Festival of Ideas. So started in 1999. By 2011, it was happening, you know, in an annex off the side of my office, and I brought Sandy Vershaw, who's now Deputy Lord Mayor, in as the executive producer. And again, it sort of happened. An advisory committee to feed ideas and somebody to go out there and raise the money.
You touched on in that last answer, I guess, those key roles that you've had within the public sector. What attracted you to working within government?
Well, there are days when I ask myself that still, you know, 12 years later, 13 years later. I've always believed in the dignity of service, and I think that is something that imprints. I've served imprints well, and that I served imprints well in that sense. I have a strong commitment to the dignity of service, and that you have to like people, you have to have an inquiring mind, you have to be able to find the line over which you don't transgress in terms of prying into people's lives, but you develop relationships. And so my imprints years, to go back to that 20 years, taught me a lot about being an interested human being and having an inquiring mind. In a sense, you guys are doing in your format now this very same thing. You take an interest in your subject and you kind of have a conversation and you learn a little bit more in the process. So when people would walk into my bookshop, and there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, I would know them by name and I would probably be able to remember what they last bought, and I would probably be able to have a half-intelligent conversation with them about what they might next be interested in, and at the same time always listening. So from there, back to your question about the public sector. It was therefore no surprise that I was not closed to the idea of public service. And an opportunity arose in 2003, and I had been an elected member of Adelaide City Council from 2000 until 2003. After having contested the Lord Mayoralty of Adelaide and obviously not been the winner, I'd made a decision that win, lose or draw, it was going to be time to make a change in my life, and that I started to look around for opportunities. And at that stage, the opportunity arose for someone to head up Arts SA, the government's main cultural funding agency and the support instrument for the Minister for the Arts, which at that stage, of course, was Mike Rann, or who at that stage was Mike Rann and John Hill as his minister assisting. I didn't think I had a snowball's chance in hell of getting that job. I'd never been a public servant. I just thought, hey, but it's a great way of waving the flag, and at least people who need to know will know that I'm in the market for a change. Because when you're married to a business, a family business, you people just expect that that's who you are and that's where you'll be for the rest of your life. And so I applied, and bugger me, I got interviewed, and absolutely bugger me, I got the job. So then suddenly I was the state's arts supremo, quote unquote, and being the chief administrator and advisor to the government about arts and culture.
Playing such a central role in, I guess, arts within South Australia, how have you seen the perception and the place of arts and culture change within South Australia over the last 20 years?
That's a really good question. I'd like to think that the process of adding new festivals to our cultural calendar and making annual the festivals that had previously been biennial has opened the pathways into a relationship with the arts to far, far more people. It's easy to forget that there was a time when the Adelaide Fringe, for example, only happened every 2 years. And, you know, you guys are old enough to remember that. Mm-hmm. And we, back then, I think the last biennial Adelaide Fringe, there were 160,000 tickets sold. And that was still the biggest festival box office units sold in the country and probably in the Southern Hemisphere. We made it annual, and I really strongly believe that that would grow the festival. And despite the fact that many of my colleagues in the arts said, "Oh no, this is just beer, you know, beer and circuses, and it's just populism," I knew that actually making things annual was respecting the rhythm of nature, and that in fact you grow your audience. You don't divide your audience in two to make an annual thing happen that had previously been biennial. And so I think now the most recent festival of most recent fringes, something like 700,000 tickets sold, and that's every year. That's every year. So I'm really, really proud of that as a significant change. Now, there are those who will, and understandably say, but that's great for a month, but then what about the rest of the year? And I think what an annual festival rhythm does here, just the same as everywhere else in the world, is it ups the ante for the companies that are producing their own seasons of productions and offerings, and it means that they have to get smarter at identifying their audience, at developing a relationship with the audience and finding ways to reach that audience. And that's a journey that we're on, no different to any other city. So I'm really quite proud of that.
What about I'm interested in the tension that exists, or if it's just perceived from my perspective, between, you know, being a creative person and working within the public sector and perhaps the the perceived limitations that may exist from a bureaucratic perspective. Am I right in assuming that?
I think that, look, it is true. There is a tension, and if you are committed to the long haul, then you pace and time your interventions and in a way that will mean that you've got a greater chance of affecting change. I'm not an artist. I see what I do and what I've contributed as being creative and toward fostering a culture that values art and creativity. But I don't take credit myself as being an artist. Artful, maybe. Mm. There are many, many knockbacks along the way, and you know there are keywords these days like agility and resilience that are kind of jargon in business speak. Well, in the arts and creativity, that's been the way of life forever. And not every kite that you fly stays up, and there are plenty of spectacular crash and burns along the way. If you're a theatre company, not every production you do is going to be a hit. If you're a dance company, et cetera, et cetera. If you're a writer, not every book that you publish is going to work. Even though sometimes they might be artistically fantastic, the marketing moment got missed or got buggered up, and so there's an awful lot that's exposed to chance.
And were you, I guess, always good at seeing that broader, higher purpose of, you know, I'm going to play the long game if I'm getting these knockbacks? Or was that something you had to learn along the way?
You definitely learn it. I mean, in my Imprints bookseller years, we were an undercapitalized small business. We constantly struggled to maintain we had cash flow, but the relationship between that and creditors was a tension the entire journey of the way. Now, that may say that someone might say, well, that means you are a less successful businessman, but we were in the business of creating a cultural enterprise and a cultural brand that would be loved and respected by people. And you know, there are many people who even today will say, oh, yes, I love Imprints and it would be terrible if it left, if it were to shut down, but they don't necessarily still shop with Imprints because life's, you know, ant tracks take them in a different direction. Keeping that respect and keeping that affection in the marketplace is important. Turning that affection and respect into transactions, that's the business kismet that you get right sometimes and you don't get right at other times. And I think I found in my public administration service, it's very much like that. Understanding what the permission environment is that you're working in. I was incredibly fortunate that during the years that Mike Rann was both Minister for the Arts, he was also Premier, and that meant he was a pretty busy guy. And once we established a trusting relationship, I was pretty well allowed to get on and do the job. And with John Hill as his minister assisting, John was able to be more engaged, and he was, and we had a really good relationship. I absolutely love my memories of that time, even though there were a lot of stories that never get told publicly.
Oh, Roost Radio, this is perfect format.
This is, you just ask Kevin Foley, he unpacked a few stories.
You did? Yeah, a few swear words and a few stories. So following on that, who else has been a key influencer, a key deal maker, someone influential in making stuff happen in South Australia that you've witnessed?
Well, from a distance and in a weird kind of way, personally, I have a lot of credit and respect for Philip Adams, the Radio National broadcaster. His Late Night Live program has been going forever, and he has been an inspiration to me and a mentor to me. And so when the idea of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas was starting to kind of foment in my head, he was the first person that I went to speak to, and he was fantastically helpful and has been a great contributor from a distance to this element of Adelaide's intellectual life when we established the Australian Centre for Social Innovation. It was Philip Adams who Mike Rann invited to be the inaugural chair, and Philip did play an important role in that setup phase. In terms of players here, I really have a huge respect for Douglas Gautier, the chief executive of the Adelaide Festival Centre. The Adelaide Festival Centre is not just a bricks and mortar place. It is a place that creates programming and it reaches out to community. Now, running a big leaky cement theatre complex is really, really hard work. I spent a few years before Douglas became chief executive. I spent a few years as a trustee of the Festival Centre 17 to 20 years ago. And back then, that organisation was virtually bankrupt. It had gone through an amazing period in the 80s and the first part of the 90s as a producer of musicals, and it had a massive, and still does, have a massive set building business as a side. The whole musical boom of that period, which, of course, you know, it was Cats, it was all of those fantastic musicals of that time. They were money for jam for the Festival Centre, and then the market changed, and you have one or two bad investments, and then suddenly the whole financial dynamics of the Festival Centre became very, very very tenuous, and Douglas came in at a time when we needed a circuit breaker. His vision was effectively a programming-led recovery rather than a shut the doors, keep the venues dark approach.
It's almost double down and
yeah, well, there was the sort of, yeah, that's right. It was sort of fight back rather than bunker in. And that, I think, that process, that journey over the last 10 or so years has been very much to the benefit of Adelaide, Adelaide's artistic community and Adelaide's audiences. There are a wiser person than me once said to me, you know, there are two major trunks of the arts and culture in South Australia. One of them is the Festival Centre and the other is the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra. It's the single largest employer of artists, and indeed it is. And if those trunks aren't viable, then you're in trouble. Now, there was a period where both were in trouble, and it wasn't just an Adelaide thing. It was a challenge for the bigger, more populous cities as well on the eastern seaboard. And, you know, methodically, we worked our way through packages that involved new government money, but also changes in the way things got organised. That's good. There have been some fantastic spirits who have shared this place with us over the years, and some wonderful artistic directors of Adelaide festivals, and those of us old enough to remember Barakowski's 1996 festival. That was a kind of a total watermark in our history. We went from Barry brought a whole generation of fringe dwellers into the main life of the main festival because of his adventurous programming. And indeed, it was backed very substantially by the government of the day under Diana Laidlaw's tenure. And what we got totally electrified Adelaide, and it showed us how the fringe as a place and space, set of spaces, and the festival could work differently. That was really good. There are some incredible creative souls. I mean, if I think of our writers, Peter Goldsworthy, an exceptional guy, and he gave great service as chair of the State Libraries Board. We're very, very fortunate. And we've also, because I guess in a sense of our size, we have been an exporter of talent as well, because we've grown more talent here than there are jobs to sustain. And people like Robin Archer, who's been a great inspiration to me, she left Adelaide many years ago, maintained a connection with Adelaide, and of course she's gone on and run all sorts of festivals, as well as being on the Australia Council for a period, and she's a force of nature that I can proudly claim as an Adelaide grown cultural talent.
As someone who over many years has demonstrated this ability to get things done with government and public sector, what would your advice be to those people out there either running businesses or running events or doing things where they're trying to talk to government, they're trying to get answers, they're trying to get things done, but maybe hitting roadblocks, whatever that might be? What would be your, I guess, some key bits of advice you could pass on?
Well, there's strategy and there's tactics. In terms of strategy, understanding what the authorising environment is, and then understanding what the influencing environment is. In Adelaide, it's not all that difficult with a bit of homework to plot and map who the agents of influence are, and indeed to understand what the structures of authorising are. And it's really, really important to do that kind of background work. Otherwise, you're knocking yourself out, knocking on doors, and getting platitudes. And you know, if you can find a champion further up the food chain than the first officer that you encounter in ArtsSA, that can be very, very helpful. But it's about due diligence. It's about doing your homework and finding those influential champions who can themselves help shift a position. I think the default position of bureaucracy universally is computer says no. it's sort of like make no change because change upsets the ectoplasm. Well, it needn't be that way, and you have to have absolutely bucket loads of guile and an ability to get knocked down and get back up again.
You've talked about the dignity of service and the community and having a high purpose. What was it like to receive the Order of Australia Medal then? What did that mean to you?
It was huge. I have to say I really never paid attention to the Australian honours beforehand. I rarely would read the Queen's Birthday or Australia Day honours lists, and I got a letter about 6 months before, or 5 months, 4 months before the formal announcement, and saying, you've been identified for receiving the Medal of the Order of Australia. Will you be in a position to accept that? And like, oh my God! And then, by the way, you can't tell a living soul about this until the Queen's Birthday or the Australia Day.
And did you tell anyone?
I did tell my partner. And I assume that they have a kind of exception for the nearest and dearest. It was a tremendous buzz. And subsequent to that, when I, because that was in 2002, it was in 2004 that I joined as head of ArtsSA. And I think somewhere in the following couple of years, Mike Rann nominated me as the South Australian government's nominee to the Council for the Order of Australia. And I spent about four and a half years as the South Australian government's contributor to that deliberation process, which was incredibly hard work, massive, massive, massive amount of reading, because each round, and there are two rounds a year, there tended to be around 1,000 to 1,300 nominations. And to do the job properly, you were required to read all of those nominations, and they were up to 10 pages per nomination. So there's a lot of reading. And each time I did it, I would go in thinking, I never want to do this again. This is just way too much time out of my life above and beyond. And each at the end of each meeting and the deliberation process, I came away feeling inspired and humbled by the amazing work that people do.
You've experienced many boards and councils and cohorts that are sort of charged with getting stuff done. What makes a really effective group of people?
Ideally, a shared understanding and a shared buy-in to the mission.
And is that not always a given?
No, no. And particularly in South Australia, people are appointed. There are many, many creative organisations that government actually owns. They're statutory authorities, and the minister of the day appoints people to boards. You're not always guaranteed that everybody who is appointed to a board has this identifies as strongly with the mission, and perhaps not always has the same amount of time to contribute above and beyond reading board papers and attending board meetings. So it can be a very, very mixed bag. You have to hope, and I've been involved with many grassroots community organisations where I've just been a board member myself, and if you're lucky, you're very lucky if you've got three or four people out of a board of maybe eight or ten who will roll their sleeves up and actually get things happening for a variety of reasons. You know, sometimes it's interest, sometimes it's capacity because people have jobs and have families and all sorts of good reasons. So it can make a huge difference. I mean, I now am in a situation working as the chief executive of the History Trust of South Australia, where I serve a board, and the board is appointed by the minister. And I'm actually, I can hand on heart say, I'm thrilled with the people who are on my board because they bring a real breadth of experience. And because I aim to be an overachiever. I hope they're pretty happy with what I do. With my other hat on, with the Adelaide Festival of Ideas, now that we've had to form a not-for-profit incorporated association to raise money and to present the Adelaide Festival of Ideas, I chair that, and so I'm in a different role. And it's interesting to jump out of one skin and into another, and sometimes you forget which skin you're in.
Mentioned this commitment to service, these various teams that you've worked with. How have you seen your evolution as a leader?
Ah, that's a really interesting question.
And why is it that the label of leader isn't really used so much within the arts community?
Maybe that's just a part of the general Australian tall poppy syndrome that, you keep your head down rather than stick it up, because otherwise someone's going to come along and lop it off. I think, though, that there are people in our sector in the arts, just as in any other sector, who understand that either by dint of their formal role or by dint of their ability to contribute and influence, that they are leaders among peers. In Imprints, we were a family business, and there, we had two point something employees, and so your opportunity to lead was really about leading yourself. It was how you conduct yourself to make happen the stuff that needs to happen. Once I went to an organisation that had 380 people within the broader Arts SA division, not all of whom, the majority of whom, were out in library, museum, art gallery, etc. You have to practice a different kind of approach, and there's a cliche, but somebody said to me once that I read somewhere that management is getting people to do what needs to be done. Leadership is getting people to want to do what needs to be done. And I think that motivation factor is part of it. And you lead by example. And so trying to model the kinds of behaviour that you're looking to cultivate in your senior team is important. And some of that is about being a chameleon. You need to tailor and adapt yourself to get the best out of people rather than expect everybody to fall into your view. One of the other factors that I think has served me well was not to try and appoint people in my own image. And somebody said, again, it was just a piece of passing advice, said, don't recruit to your own type. Recruit across your type. The energy will be sometimes difficult to navigate, but actually, by and large, your mission will be better served. In the public sector, you inherit people and they own jobs, and that therefore has a different kind of dynamic to being, you know, in the not-for-profit sector or being in the private sector. So again, it's just about understanding what tools, what levers you have to work with, and making judgment calls.
One moment that you might have just misread the play on, or that didn't get up, or I guess setback that you had, one specific example that you can remember?
When the Adelaide Festival of Ideas lost its arts essay funding, That was a fairly signature setback. At that stage, I had since moved on from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas because of the years that I spent writing the checks for the Festival of Ideas as the government's principal arts agency thing. That was a bit of a setback, and yet I knew there were people who shared the commitment and the vision of the place of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas in the intellectual heart of Adelaide's cultural DNA. And so, you know, I probably still am on a journey of reconciling that for reasons other than the performance or the value of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas, it lost its government funding. But what it did do was galvanise me and others to form a not-for-profit incorporated association and to get out there and to make it happen. And we made it happen in 2016. I'm really, really proud of what we managed to make happen. And it'll be back again in 2018. We're moving it back to July, which was the month in which it was originally presented over the first decade of its life. And we're moving it down to the West End, which for me is a bit of an emotional homecoming, given my decades of involvement in that part of the city.
It strikes me that having this higher purpose and this vision and something other than just the dollars or the sort of, allegiance to it being your thing, having that higher purpose allows you to actually get through these moments because you go, right, well, this vehicle, this method of what we're doing is now not quite working and we've got to adapt to another method to achieve this. Do you actively tell people about missions and visions, or is it assumed and implied when you go about your business?
I would like to think that if I'm having a conversation with somebody who I don't think has already got got with the program, or at least understands the purpose and mission, that I spend time to share that with them. You know, this thing about the elevator pitch is really, really valuable, and being able to distill into two sentences what your thing is about is incredibly, incredibly important. The rest of it, you need to take feedback from people and actually gauge their interests. I mean, when people have said to me over the last year and a half, so what do you do? And if I say, oh, I run the History Trust of South Australia, people will sort of tend to glaze over and move on. And the conversation moves on, which I'm quite comfortable with. But if I respond differently and say...
Is this your pitch coming?
Well, let's give us a bit of a soft pitch. So, you know, the History Trust of South Australia is committed to giving the past a future now through the operation of museums and a history festival. We are committed to preserving and sharing the stories of South Australia's history.
Very good. How has the culture within the public sector and government changed in its approach towards art over your journey?
It's probably not popular amongst my arts comrades to hear me say this, but the reality is in the things that actually count to the electorate, the arts, surprisingly, is probably around about number 64. We have to get over ourselves. We have to understand that there are an awful lot of things that matter a lot more to the great majority of people.
And, yeah, it's trumpeted as in the top three or four things that anyone else from afar will talk about when referring to us, which is funny,
isn't it? It's quite a paradox, really. I'm talking about the brutal real politic. If you were sitting as the treasurer, the arts is just a complete pain in the ass because it doesn't deliver perhaps the employment outcomes that some other areas of industry do, but people understand that it is part of our identity. Where I think perhaps the arts needs to do a better job, and I'm making my contribution to the conversation about this, is not to subvert our purpose to the econometrics of business case. That is, of course, a part of it. We don't exist in a bubble. We exist in a very competitive environment when it comes to government funding. We also live in an incredibly competitive marketplace when it comes to the things, the discretionary items in people's lives. And art is a discretionary item, but for a very, very small proportion of people for whom art is central to their existence, in the main, it's not. And therefore, we have to show that the reason we exist is for something different. I'm not going to equate art with religion, but in the same way that faith is something that drives people's behaviour if they are people of faith, no matter what the creed. A passion for art and a respect for the role of the artist and the place of art as a way of telling ourselves who we are and telling other people who we are, that is something that you can't do in dollars and cents. It has to be framed around the intrinsic value of the mission. Mm. And I think in some areas we've lost that because the forms that we have to fill in to try and get money from government or from tourism or whatever are all about economic outcomes. impact. And so we've got a responsibility as advocates and champions for the arts to, in a sense, lift the policy conversation, lift the political conversation to something that is actually understands that it's actually also about identity, and that identity is something you can't put a price tag on. Identity is something about who we are and why we exist in this massive planet of competing cultures and populations and languages, et cetera, et cetera.
If you could pick two or three changes or innovations, I guess, pragmatic things that can be done to improve the landscape, what would they be?
You mean to improve the arts landscape?
Yeah, to improve this conversation and the perception of where the arts culture fits.
I would say... and respectfully to my many, many arts peers and the new generations that are coming forward, understand that it's a journey of hearts and minds, and that just making art for art's sake is perfectly fine as an individual purpose, but if to do that you need to win money to help make it happen, then walk a mile in the shoes of your prospective audience and in the shoes of your prospective funders. Have some regard to the fact that you've got to win hearts and minds. Be more, be more entrepreneurial. There are now ways that an individual practicing artist can invite donations from other private individuals who are not their direct immediate family, and they'll get a tax deduction in the process. It's called the Australian Cultural Fund, and I think it should be compulsory before anyone asks for a grant from government that they have registered their project with the Australian Cultural Fund, and have started to think about their own networks of people who might be motivated. It's a bit like crowdfunding. It's like crowdfunding, except that this crowdfunding doesn't deliver a direct, tangible, material benefit to the donor. It is a genuine tax-deductible donation, so you can't receive a free copy of or whatever as a result. I've advised and helped set up a number of these projects within the Australian Cultural Fund, and for the people who are prepared to sort of put the you know, whatever the term is, to get with the project and actually start telling, selling and winning hearts and minds, it can be a really helpful way of kickstarting and in some cases actually fully funding the project that they're looking for. Government cannot and never has been the only game in town, and I would like to think that the next chapter in our cultural development is going to focus on helping foster a greater culture of self-reliance amongst our artists. I'm certainly pro tiers of government continuing to make a priority about investing in the arts and culture. Absolutely, there's a place for it. But we're going to get the real value add by fostering the culture of philanthropy, of personal giving, and perhaps more so than corporate philanthropy or corporate sponsorship here in South Australia. We're not the centre of the universe for corporate HQ, but there are a lot of people who have been incredibly supportive of other forms of charity, whether it's about social inclusion or about disadvantage, where we have to compete in that space, and we have to make our opportunity compelling. So we've got to sell. We've got to sell ourselves better.
Mm.
Is it time for a little rapid fire section yet?
I think rapid fire slash punter's corner, which is kind of, because I've got some nuffy questions that I want to ask. So this is typically where we'll ask a series of questions, Greg, and feel free to be as short as you can with your answers, although it never ends up being like that.
No, feel free to go and long as well.
Typically, Andrew sort of falls down in this segment. So my question is, if you're going to pick an arts channel that you are most in love with, whether it's visual, whether it's music, like the range, you're going to have to pick one, what would it be?
It would be music, because it's something that I can access every single day of my life.
You started out as a musician, didn't you?
Yes. I was a guitar player, a bit of a balladeer, a cabaret musician back in the 70s before DJs came and killed the bar
disco,
and the club. Yeah.
Before disco killed the vibe.
Yeah. So, music. Music's a big part of my life. As an art form, though, as a performing art form, contemporary dance floats my boat big time.
Okay. With your history essay hat on, what would be, maybe five's too much, but top...
Now go five.
Stretch him. Your top five sites or locations that anyone interested in South Australian history should go and check out.
Whoa, okay.
And if it's not five, it can be three.
Well, or you could just quickly Google in front of us. you got your screen in front of you.
Places, I certainly include the Copper Coast and the role of mining, Moonta, Burra, that whole area that played a huge part in driving and deriving wealth for the what was then the colony or the province of South Australia. It's a wonderful area of our history. In terms of pre-European occupation, and so we're talking about Indigenous history. I guess, and geological history as well. It would be up in the Flinders Ranges and the places where Aboriginal communities flourished, and where in geological time sense, you know, we've had the richest revelations about our past. I'm a bit of a fan of, you know, in a pop culture sense, of the Big Lobster down in the southeast.
I drove past the Big Koala 2 weekends ago, actually, and it seemed very unhappy, and tired.
The obsession with things big is not an exclusively South Australian or even Australian thing. It's a cultural phenomenon around the world. I love that. On the Port Wakefield Road, heading toward Port Wakefield, there's a set of sculptures that obviously a farmer or a landowner with quite a warped imagination has set up, and they're quite often
political.
Quite political. I love that. I love everything about Port Adelaide. There are some polluted places, of course, because of the years of less enlightened industry and waste disposal. But Port Adelaide offers South Australia and Australia one of the greatest potentials. If we can get a sensitive accommodation between renewal, residential, urban renewal, and as well as our heritage, it's a spectacular place for future generations. Of course, I would be remiss if I didn't say North Terrace, the cultural boulevard between Kintore Avenue and Frome. And I really do believe that the old Royal Adelaide Hospital campus has the greatest potential for this century to be where we build our amazing future cultural heritage. So, there's a few.
Mm. Yeah. Because we're just a couple of jocks asking some sort of artistic and cultural questions, an important moment where culture, art, and sport has merged that you can remember?
Well, it would have to be the opening and closing ceremonies of the 2000 Sydney Olympics, if we're talking about Australia.
Yeah.
That was pretty fun and pretty memorable, and from the fireworks to Kylie's thong and etc. I love.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I did. Mm. I love pop. I love popular culture as well as perhaps the more artful end of the spectrum. I'm not an exclusivist or an elitist in that way at all.
To take you out of Adelaide, what piece of art or culture or event or festival has had the biggest impact on you?
You mean out of Adelaide, yeah, but still in South Australia?
Disconnected to Adelaide, so interstate or international.
Yeah, look, as a gay man, I would have to say my first couple of Mardi Gras in the early 80s had a pretty significant impact on me in terms of realising, hey, I'm not alone. that was pretty memorable and pretty much a kind of a total touch base. I was a younger man back then, and so I might have been amongst the pretty young things, and that was pretty electrifying. But the 1996 Adelaide Festival of Arts was, for me, in terms of the broader me, the most sensational collection of experiences and memories that I hold. Performances that just blew my mind. Places that were created, Red Square with all the shipping containers. It was one of the first, the shipping container villages are a dime a dozen now, but back then that was really cutting edge and adventurous. And I think that everything that Barry Koski and the Adelaide Festival of Arts presented that year was sensational and life affirming and for me life changing.
The object or thing that you have purchased that's maybe the most obscene, expensive thing that you can't justify but you just love?
Oh, there's no question about the answer to this. It is a large work by Christopher Orchard, Adelaide artist, and who was the star, really, effectively, of the Sala Festival this year. His work and images on the front cover of the Sala program. It's a major retrospective, and there was a publication, a monograph, a book about his career. A few years ago, it's probably about 5 years ago, there was an exhibition at BMG, a gallery. At that stage, it was in the city, and my partner and I went along to it on a Friday night, and while his back was turned, I went to Trudy Ann Brown, one of the owners of the thing, and said, can you put a red dot on that?
Did you know the price?
Yeah. As she did say, I will do a family rate for you, Greg, which was very, very lovely. But, I mean, I paid $16,000 for a work of art, a very large work of art, and a week prior to that, I'd made my partner, Jonathan, get refund on two return tickets to South America, because I said, we can't afford it. We can't afford it.
Yeah, but so it's an investment.
I lived in, you know, I was in the doghouse for a good year for that.
But that's disappointing, because generally the obscene things depreciate drastically, you know, cars or, you know, boats, but yours is only going to appreciate. So it's not a bad decision.
I'd like to think that, but it's an investment that I will never intend to part
redeem
with, you know, until maybe I'm in the maximum security Twilight Village and there isn't a wall big enough.
That's your super.
For it. Yeah.
Greg, thank you for giving us the time to come and listen to your story and all the vast amount of things that you've been involved with, and really what has been a significant body of work already in your contributions to South Australia and Adelaide. And we wish you best for the future, and we're so glad we finally got a chance to have you on Rooster Radio. Yeah, so thank you
guys. I've really enjoyed it. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to our chat with Greg Mackey. We have plenty of interesting interviews in the bank and many more to come. So subscribe to Rooster Radio, and if you like what we're doing, please leave us a review in iTunes. And connect with us at roosterradio.biz. We'd love to hear from you.